All right, so good evening again. So as we continue our journey through the Paramis, through the 10 perfections, we're rounding up this month on truthfulness. Truthfulness. You know, often in our practice we have different insights, different realizations. We start to see life in a different way, different perspective on things. But unless we are able to integrate that seeing into our daily life, it has more or less limited value. And we start to turn toward this expression of truth, of speech through truthfulness. It's a way we start to align our insights with our life. And it's not always an easy or smooth journey. Sometimes we're surprised by the distance between our insights and our actual actions in life. So tonight I'd like to explore truthfulness, and particularly these three gateways of speech that can serve as an important guide, not only with our verbal speech, but also our actions of body and also of mind, our own way we hold our own self in our self-talk. Often there's a sense of momentum of our conditioning, of our ignorance, our patterns of suffering that overwhelms the momentum of our insights. And actually choosing to act from our insights to align ourselves, often a very conscious process, starts to change that momentum, starts to change that kind of set point. Because each moment we have a choice of what are we reinforcing. Reinforcing our deepest understanding, our deepest expression of compassion? Or are we reinforcing our conditioning, the ways that cause harm, pain to ourselves and toward others? So how we live does matter, and how do we actually show up in our lives? Often we see this in the training precepts, the five precepts, and the Eightfold Path, this important bringing forth our wisdom, our compassion into our actions of life. So it becomes really a proving ground of our insights, proving ground of how we understand wisdom. Without a clear and consistent understanding of what is true, our lives are really based in often our sense of unconsciousness, our sense of ignorance. We're lost in reactivity, in fear, in illusion. So learning how to identify what's clear and then to act from that is really what this night is about. Just focusing on speaking what's true often isn't enough in itself. So, okay, what's true, and then I'm going to speak from that. We also have to bring these other elements in of seeing, is this true? Is it beneficial? And is the timing right? Is the timing right? So these three gates of speaking, we'll go through each of these gates in turn, looking at how they provide a kind of a checkpoint. So, okay, is this a true statement? Is this a true expression? Is it beneficial to be shared? And then finally, is the timing right? And we'll weave in and out of a sutta from the Majjhima Nikaya, the Middle Length Discourses, number 58, to Prince Abhihaya to explore these three gates. Also, in this sutta, he particularly looks at whether something is pleasant or unpleasant to hear, and how does that factor in as we look at this path of right speech and of truthfulness. Because this pleasantness and unpleasantness is often what we key in on. Okay, this is going to be, I really want to say this because they're going to enjoy hearing that, or they're not going to enjoy it. And we hear something, I really don't like that feedback, or it really kind of strokes my ego and it's easy to hear. That's often what we key on. But as we look at the sutta, the Buddha really changes that on its head. That consideration is secondary to whether it's true and beneficial. So let's explore the sutta a little bit to set the stage, and we'll kind of weave in and out of this sutta. So back in the time of the Buddha, sometimes we imagine that he was very much revered, that everyone really honored him. But at the time of the Buddha, there was lots of different teachers, and there was a bit of, you know, competition People were to argue and debate each other, trying to show how one teacher is wiser than another one. So this is kind of the environment that the Buddha taught in. And some of the suttas really point to this, the sense of establishing his teaching as being wiser. So there's this one teacher who wanted to try to trip up the Buddha, kind of get him caught in a difficult question. So he recruited this prince, I always think of him as a young prince, to kind of go talk to the Buddha and ask him this question. And say, okay, if you ask the question the right way, you'll trap the Buddha and show that he's really not such a good teacher after all. Because the Buddha was really growing in fame, and I imagine this other teacher had a sense of feeling jealous, feeling inadequate. And so he promised this prince, okay, if you trip up the Buddha, then you'll get all this renown for having shown that the Buddha really wasn't so wise. So he talked this prince, he's kind of a pawn into his scheme, to asking the Buddha a trick question. It's a very simple question, and he called it a two-pronged question, using an analogy of like a chestnut that has these two horns on it, that if you start to swallow it and you realize you're swallowing this thing, if you try to spit it up, it causes pain and harm. If you try to swallow it, it causes pain and harm. So it's like, just the Buddha to swallow this question and he would really get caught in it. So the question was simple. Would the Buddha say words that are unendearing and disagreeable to others? Would the Buddha say words that are unendearing and disagreeable to others? So this other teacher said, if the Buddha says yes, then you should say, then how is there any difference between you, Lord, and the run-of-the-mill people? For even run-of-the-mill people say words that are unendearing and disagreeable to others. So basically proving the Buddha is not actually so wise, not such a special teacher after all. But if he says no, this is the other prong of the question, then you say, well then, Lord, how did you say of Devadatta that Devadatta is headed for dissolution, Devadatta is headed for hell, Devadatta will boil for an eon, Devadatta is incurable? For Devadatta was upset and disgruntled at those words of yours. Yeah, so okay, I'll trap him in that. And so, just as a side, Devadatta was one of his cousin, and had actually tried to assassinate him. So he was quite a troublemaker at that time. And the Buddha was giving him some very clear feedback about that behavior. And so when the Buddha was going to be asked this question, the idea is that he won't be able to swallow it, he won't be able to spit it out, and he can really get trapped in this. So the prince decides, okay, I'll go along with this, and invites the Buddha over to his house and, you know, offers him food in a very respectful way, and then finally asks the question, Lord, would the Buddha say words that are unendearing and disagreeable to others? And the Buddha said, Prince, there's no categorical yes or no answer to that. So it's like, okay, that's not going to work. He caught me. And then the Buddha the prince has to kind of lay out kind of this scheme and spill the beans about this setup. And this leads to this very beautiful exploration of what really is wise speech. And the Buddha basically lays out this matrix with these three qualities of considerations of being true, and being beneficial, and being timely. And essentially, the Buddha said, okay, don't say something if it's not true, just period. If it's not true and beneficial, don't say it. Now, if it's true and beneficial, then you have to gauge whether it's unpleasant to hear. If it's unpleasant, then you have to look at the timing of it. When is it the right time? When's the right time of receptivity to share that? Also, if it's pleasant to hear and true and beneficial, you also look at the timing. Look at the timing of that. How receptive will that be? So let's take at these three aspects of being true, of being beneficial, and the right timing as a framework for this exploration. So is it true? So first we have to be able to perceive what is actually true in this moment. What does the truth really mean? The last time I talked, at the beginning of the month, we explored this, like the difference between the relative truth, the personal truth, versus the more absolute or universal truth. and how we often confuse those two, and how much harm is caused by that confusion. So the relative truth, as I explored, you know, again, at the beginning of the month, has these hallmarks of resonance, kind of a deep sense of, okay, this feels right. And also has this hallmark of simplicity. There's not a lot of inner dialogue, a lot of justification. There's a sense of just resting in truth. There's a resonance and a simplicity to it. If we're spending a lot of time elaborating and justifying, we need to look a little deeper, allow that to sink in a little more, to allow that to hold, to arise. And relative truth, and personal truth, I think should always be held rather lightly. Because it is just your perception, it's your experience, and may not be someone else's experience. And we hold our experience as being so tightly and true, it sets up potential for huge conflict. So we see this moment's truth is really just that. It's this arising at this moment, and it's not permanent, it's not lasting. To see really what's true in this moment, I'll offer a couple guidelines that may be helpful. Kind of two agreements you can make with yourself if you're trying to explore, okay, what's really true in this moment for me, with my own experience as a human being. One agreement is not to have to act on this. To suspend the need to act, to speak, to do something about that, at least for the time being. Because often when we try to investigate what's true, the pressure of acting, how am I going to say this? How am I going to relate to this? What this is going to mean for the rest of my life, kind of obscures our ability to really see the truth. So setting that aside, you have to pick that up at some point perhaps, but for at least for a little while, suspending the need to act. The other agreement is the willingness to fully see what's present. Not having to act gives you the permission to fully open to what's going on, what's fully true in the heart and the mind, you know, including the parts that we judge that we like to rather not be present. So you can fully see whatever is present, whatever is here. This quality of relative truth, being able to tap into that, to really be clear about that. That, again, a sense of resonance, a sense of simplicity, and then from there to speak from that. Now the other type of truth, the absolute truth, is a little more tricky. Again, often relative truth masquerades as this absolute truth. So if you find yourself having to elaborate, to justify, to explain, it's a good clue it's probably not an absolute truth. A good rule of thumb is that if you can describe it, articulate it, it's probably not absolute, because absolute takes us beyond words, beyond concepts, beyond ideology, beyond belief, dogma. It's beyond that. It's a different way of, it's a different perception beyond our normal way of thinking. Okay, so when we start to hold something as being absolutely true, when it's not, that sets us up for justifying harm, justifying racism, justifying all the ills that we cause in other people, all the hurt we cause in other people. These two qualities of relative and absolute truth. So I think it's also important to pause and say, why is it important to connect with what's true? To really have a sense of direct connection with that. To go to another teacher from the Gospel of Thomas, Jesus has famously said, if you bring forth what is within you, what you bring forth will save you. If you do not bring forth what is within you, what you do not bring forth will destroy you. This is an expression of connecting with what's true and allowing that to come forth. This can be taken on many different levels, many different experiences of this statement. And we will explore, you know, especially in this next section of being of beneficialness. When you think about something that you you deny, that you repress, that you don't allow to have full expression, it creates a huge charge, a huge sense of pressure in the system. Okay? So there's a psychological part, there's a mental part, but it's also very much linked to our suffering. It's very linked to our place of identification, of how much we believe in this. Right? The more we hold something as untrue, it creates a big charge around that. The sense of really expressing what is true, there's the release of that charge. There's a release of that constriction. Okay, in that release, there's also the release of identification. In that release of identification, there's a lessening of our suffering. So truth also has this quality of emerging. You know, if you've ever studied insight dialogue, one of their principles is trust emergence. To trust, instead of planning what you're going to say, trust that it will naturally emerge out. And this is a beautiful statement because it allows us to hold truth as something that's very alive in the moment, that arises and it has a certain life. But then at that point, then it fades and there's another truth that arises. So we don't hold on to the same truth and say, okay, I'm going to kind of constrict around it, make it solid, allow it to be fluid. So the truth shows up in this moment as an expression. Now often as we explore truth, we may have from our wisdom side, our insights, our understandings, our wisdom, our compassion shows up, and also our past wounding. Our past pain arises in the moment. And so it's interesting to look at our relationship with truth and the story, the details, the elaboration, the meaning that we make around these past experiences, our past insights. And sometimes we go beyond that simplicity of the truth. We go beyond it to start to make something more and more of a story around it. It starts to take on a life of its own. So going back to that simplicity, that simple resonance of what's true, which is often in the core of that. You know, people may have a very painful history, much wounding. And there's a whole story about what happened and what it did. But how does it really show up in the moment is the most pertinent question. Not so much the details of what happened, but how does it manifest in the moment? How does it change how I relate to myself and others? That question is also, said another way, is showing how do we constrict? How do we identify? How do we fall in to the second noble truth of craving, of wanting and not wanting? So falling back to this resonance, really tuning ourselves to find that deep resonance, that deep simplicity as a guide to what is true. Another aspect of truth is past actions. So can we own deeply what we did, what we actually did to someone else, what we said, how we acted, but also realizing that I may not no longer be that same person. So a sense of deep responsibility, but at the same time, not forming a sense of self around that, making amends, apologizing, whatever is needed, but at the same time not making that a new sense of who we are. Because that's straying from the truth. It's an elaboration. So this first gateway of truth is in some ways the most essential. What is really true? But even that, it's like hold yourself to a high bar of that. To not hold yourself as, this is, you know, whatever my first impulse, my first sense of reactivity, that's my truth. To realize that that's a truth just relatively manifesting in the moment. It's just arising, not something to constrict around. So again, if it's not true, doesn't have this quality of truth, then not to say it. The next gateway is whether it's beneficial. This is beneficial. Does it lead toward the aim of practice? So again, this is a very high standard. Does it lead to awakening? Does it lead to liberation? Does it lead to the end of suffering? We can view awakening as really the seeing through the illusion of separation, illusion of a separate sense of self, seeing through the illusion of permanence, to actually see that life is always in flux. Seeing through the sense of hoping for satisfaction, a sense of deep happiness in things which are always in change, this quality of dukkha. So awakening is seeing through this illusion. It's interesting, when we speak the truth, there's often this loosening of the identification. You've experienced that. If there's something you're afraid to admit, to really share to someone, you know, maybe some wrongdoing or just a painful experience, or the effect of how someone impacted you, the quality of feeling your heart hurt. When we have that sense of shame around it, sense of constriction, not wanting to share it, when you finally actually are able to share it and be met in that sharing, there's a lightness that comes after that. There's a sense of relief as we've let go of that burden. And what's happened is we've let go of a quality of identification. We've let go of a way of forming I, me, and mine around that. In this way, speaking the truth can be immensely beneficial. Receiving someone else's truth can be immensely beneficial. It's an interesting paradox that often when we have something to say to someone, the quality of, you know, I want to share how I was hurt by this experience, or a sharing of a sense of vulnerability, before we say it, it has such a charge, such a sense of being true. Be like, this is my truth. After we share it, though paradoxically, it loses that charge. We really see it as being just a moment's arising. We just see it as relatively true. Before we speak it, it's heavy with our identification, with meaning. And after speaking it, we start to see, at least part of us sees, that it's just another aspect, another play of the mind. It has no inherent meaning of who we are. We see that we're bigger than that. We're beyond that limited constriction. So often I talk about, as we kind of combine mindfulness with qualities of investigation, we start to see these different levels of constriction, different ways we take meaning, the ways we identify in the moment. And the purpose of doing that is to show the different layers of identification. So each set point, each place where we have that belief structure, opening to the felt sense in the body, noticing the subtle beliefs, is we're starting to unhook that set point of identification. And after we see through it, there's a stillness that arises, and perhaps a deeper quality arises, another set point that we keep opening to. And we do this until there's a place that we land where there's actually no place to stand. There's not a sense of identification. This is who I am. There's a sense of deep stillness. This deep quiet. In this way, the very conflict of our life provides this perfect gateway to our own liberation. So is it beneficial? Does it help release this quality of identification, of sense of who I am, self-making? Often with speaking the truth, and in a sense of, and if it's a beneficial, part of it, what makes it beneficial is being fully heard, fully received. Right? So at first we learn how to do that for ourselves, to fully be able to acknowledge, okay, this is what's here, this is what's arising, this is the quality of pain or of joy, whatever it might be, and to be able to actually express that. Is that deep acknowledgement. And if we're lucky enough, we start to find other people who are able to hold that, to really hold who we are. I was just at the teen retreat at IBME, And one of the things, one of the hallmarks of that retreat is the teens, the vast majority, feel they could be completely who they are. Perhaps in their first time in their life, they didn't feel the pressure of having to conform to their society's pressures, conform to what their parents wanted or their teachers wanted. And there's a sense of really beauty as they often open to painful things and joyful things, a sense of deep innocence that emerged as they're able to really discover and touch in to what's true for them. And I hope as they touched into that, that becomes this reference point that they can always call upon, even in the midst of a society that often says they should be a certain way other than they are. Giving that sense of permission to be fully who they are, this allows the truth to be fully received and allows it to be deeply beneficial. Now, as you reflect on this sense of being beneficial, it's good to also step back and say, do I have an agenda? Do I have a reason for I want to say this to this person? Do I want to fix them? Do I want to change them? Do I want to make them better than they are? Do I'm trying to build myself up in some way to show I'm very wise or know what I'm superior in some way? You know, am I trying to change that person? So often reflecting on this, when my therapist said, learning to let people learn their lessons at their own pace. To learn their lessons in their own way, at their own time, instead of trying to force that lesson on them. So seeing there's a sense of urgency of having to act, to speak, is a good way to go back in and question this beneficialness. So the three gateways, the first two gateways of truth, is it true, is it beneficial? And then finally, is the timing right? Is the timing right? So again, in this sutta, the Buddha looked at these two gateways as being essential. And if it was pleasant or unpleasant to hear, then looking at what's the right timing. You might think of it also as what's the right gateway or what's the right delivery method. Often I've been witness to and sometimes participated in painful email exchanges. You know, that way of delivering information, especially of a charged nature, of a painful nature, is so easy to be misinterpreted. To be, because so much of a communication is nonverbal. And without that quality of warmth, the quality of connection, it can be misinterpreted. So delivery, timing. It's interesting to turn that lens of timing on ourselves too, because this journey is essentially a journey toward ourselves, to truly aligning with who we are as human beings and seeing the nature of that in a very deep way. Yeah. So there's an expression of truth, there's a sense of beneficiality. There's also an expression of timing too. Because, you know, for many of us, if we have a history of trauma, of abuse, of very difficult things, if we're going through a lot of grief, a lot of deep loss, or just tremendous changes in our life, there's a truth that's often undeniable. But the timing of it, sometimes we go into it too quickly, too fast, so we become overwhelmed, we become swept off our feet. So learning this quality of titration, of balancing how much do we open to this deep truth and how much do we actually shift our attention someplace else. So our mindfulness is balanced, is able to be receptive to this deeper pain. Not going faster than our heart is naturally able to hold it. That sense of respect, letting yourself learn your lessons at your own time. So often when you're not doing this, there's this kind of voice inside that's saying, okay, I need to really dig into this. I really got to get to the bottom of this. I've got to really get through this. Okay, all those little inclinations, all those flavorings of your practice, use those as a wake-up call to come back into receptivity, into balance, into patience, and the simple willingness to see. And allow things to be shown at their own pace when the heart and mind is ready to open to that. Now, timing we can also look at as this quality of giving feedback and receiving feedback. So giving feedback, you know, we say, okay, this is true, it feels relatively true, this feels like it would be beneficial to speak this, to say this. Then I want to, I've kind of checked my agenda around what might be there. And I want to tell someone something that's true about them. Okay, already we're kind of getting into shaky ground. You know, we're treading on shaky ground when we say, I want to tell you something that's true. So some guidelines, thinking about asking for permission. Does this person really want to receive feedback? Are they willing to receive this interpretation? In a sense of owning that, this is just your experience. This is just your perception, which, like anyone, is limited. It's distorted and conditioned by our history, by our background. How we see life is not a universal. This is just my sense of this. To take it and see if it resonates, and if not, to release it. Often in, after a, especially in the Thai forest tradition as a monastic, after finishing, we have a very nice saying of, please take what is of benefit from this talk, and what is not of benefit, to release it. So to give feedback in that attitude, and not that they have to change, they have to take it on, they have to prove that they got it. It is a simple offering that may be received or not. You can often hear in your language, do I use I statements? Do I have a sense of ownership that I felt this way, or I felt this impact of this interaction, versus you are always. When you find yourself using those absolute global statements, you are never, you're always, you are, you made me, you should go, oh. Let me pause for a second. Let me take responsibility for my own experience. Okay, I felt hurt when you said this. Coming with a sense of kindness, a sense of kind heart. And this is often a big part of the timing. Especially when something is really charged, it takes a time for that charge to start to dissipate, to start to really let it quiet down, so you can speak with a clear head and a kind heart. From a kindness of heart. I really see this sense of beneficialness. In one tradition, they have this quality of polishing the stone. And this, when you're giving feedback to someone, of course it's all agreed upon that I want to receive feedback. And the idea is you're holding the person as being already perfect, already whole, already complete. And they may just have a little smudge here, a little dent there. So you're holding the wholeness of the person and offering this is a simple thing to look at. And when I've participated in this, it's often such a gift when it's done well, when I'm able to receive it and monitor that I'm not tensing up and pushing it away, to really receive that feedback. It often shows a blind spot and a power I didn't even know I was doing. It can be very fruitful, very positive. Even though at first, you know, it kind of stings, it kind of hurts a little bit. So when you offer a truth, to make sure you're going from a vulnerable place, a sense of sensitivity, a sense of softness of the heart, and a willingness to hear back what the other person may say and offer back to you. Like just this morning, my wife and I were talking about a little difficulty we had, and you know, hearing her point of view, and you know, saying, okay, there's kind of my side that arises in counterpoint, that sense of conflict with that experience. But being willing to listen, to really hear the impact of my actions, of my words. And by doing that, we're really exploring the truth together. I could say, okay, here's my perspective, the way I came into that, and the limitations of that. And that way, we both felt held, both felt met in that moment, in that interaction. So speaking, when it's true and it's beneficial and the timing is right, to speak from a place of vulnerability. That you're offering something and also willing to be changed by that interaction, to really hear. By doing that, it really safeguards us. Because when we don't have that vulnerability, when our heart is closed, we're not open to hearing it being a dialogue. Because remember, the truth is very rarely absolute. If you can speak about it, it's not so absolute. It's relative. It's a different experience, like the parable about the blind people and the elephant. You know, they each had a different part of that elephant and said, this is my reality, this is my experience, and your experience is wrong. Just because each person had a limited experience. Right? So if we hold the truth in that way, we're able to hear, oh, let me hear your relative truth. And by doing this, this is all in the service of loosening the quality of identification, loosening the way we constrict around our emotions, our mental constructs, our belief system. That loosening of the identification leads us toward liberation, loosens the deep roots of suffering. That's why truthfulness isn't just a moral teaching. It's an important part of that, but it's much more important. It directly aligns us with our heart's liberation, with our heart's freeing, our unbinding of our heart. You know, receiving feedback. In our local Dharma leader groups, we often have someone offer a short talk or a short meditation, and we then practice consciously giving feedback in a way that's, again, kind, considerate, but also as a gift. So it's offered as a gift, that the person takes that gift and says, hey, does that fit or doesn't fit? I think it was Gurdjieff's father who gave him this advice, that when someone gives you feedback, Take it in, but don't accept it right away. Say, don't respond yes or no, but just take it in, take it and sleep on it, basically. Take it for a test drive. And that way you kind of work through your initial reactivity, your initial denial. And say, okay, does this really fit? And sometimes it really points out a blind spot. And sometimes it's much more about the other person than you. That sense of being receptive, being open to doing that, we have to step outside our positionality, which is another way of saying stepping outside our conditioning, our identification. So these three gates of, is it true? Is it beneficial? And is it the timing right? Allows us to start to align with the expression of truths. We allow for our deepest understanding to start to show up in our lives. It can take this form of how we speak to another, how we speak to ourselves, how we experience ourselves, but also how we act in the world, that sense of alignment. And when you feel people are going the wrong way, are you willing to go that path, which may lead to ridicule, friction, but you know in your heart that this is the right direction. Again, to go back to our Christian friends in John 8:32, when Jesus said, then you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free. The truth will set you free. Not that the truth becomes something that we hold on to, but the truth is what liberates. So practicing truthfulness internally, externally, allowing ourselves to really resonate with, is this beneficial? Is it truly beneficial? And then is the timing right to receive internally and externally? So let's just sit quietly for a moment or two. And as you sit, sit without a sense of how you should be in this moment. What if it didn't matter if your mind was full of thoughts or completely still? If your body was at peace and still or full of agitation and discomfort? What if it didn't matter? All you had to do was simply attend to what actually is here, not what you think should be or you hope would be or don't want. And this deep quality of acknowledgement allows us to fully see what's the truth of this moment and of this moment. All right, thank you for your kind attention. I'd just like to say a few words about the practice and reflection for this week. So truthfulness, the three gateways of speech. So this week, and you can do this for the rest of your life if you like to, is before speaking or writing, practice moving through the three gates of speech. One, is this true? Holding relative truth lightly and remembering absolute truth is beyond words. Okay, so if something may feel very true to you, and it is relatively true, but you realize it has a limitation. It's not universal. People may have a completely different experience. At the same time, you need to really deeply acknowledge that, but the same of your own truth, but be receptive to someone else's expression. Number two, is this beneficial? Does it lead to the end of suffering through the release of identification? The release of identification. Tracking how identification shows up is a very fruitful quality of practice. To start to attune yourself to where do I identify? Where do I constrict? Where do I take this as being I, me, and mine? Not as a way to not judging that. Judgment's just a more subtle form of identification around it. But to notice that this is how I'm constricting. Okay? And then what expression of truth allows that to be released, to allow that to be softened. And then finally, is this the right timing? Am I open-hearted? Am I vulnerable? And is the other person receptive and willing? So take these on when you have something to share. Just practice going through these three qualities of true, beneficial, and the timing, the right timing. And then for extra credit, can you also pass your inner dialogue through these three gates? You know, instead of this thinking about the external speech, what about the internal speech? Can you imagine if you never said anything to yourself that wasn't true? That wasn't beneficial, that wasn't able to be received in the right timing, how your inner world would be transformed. You probably wouldn't have a lot to say to yourself, which is kind of the point. All right, so we have some time for some dialogue and questions. And Iris, can we turn on the lights so I can see beyond the shadows? What's out there, if anything? Yes, Iris.
I'm thinking someplace in the suttas also, some commentary that I'm thinking of actually five guidelines around speech, the other two being, is it necessary and is it kind? Are those kind of included in these three that we've laid out?
Yeah, so that sutta I'm not as familiar with, whether it's kind and is it necessary. I think and there's also, if you look at the Eightfold Path, there's also qualities of wise speech, like it's not idle chatter and not harsh speech, and that's perhaps what you're referring to. I think we can kind of sometimes stretch things to include it. Sometimes that's good, sometimes not. But since I've beneficial in timing, that kindness of heart, you know, also, and the timing, or the beneficialness, is this really necessary? Is it necessary to help? Because if it's not necessary, it doesn't really lead to that quality of release of suffering. And the quality of a kind heart is also that timing. So they're like, I got to tell you something. You know, it's that sense of kindness becomes the lead. So sometimes different words resonate in different ways for us. So, you know, it's good to just kind of play with it and say, okay, what really allows these basic guidelines of being really attuned to myself and speaking from a place of kindness? Yeah, I think it's interesting with speech. I didn't talk about this, but if you're like me, you often think, okay, if it's true and it's beneficial and I have the timing right, I'm going to have a good outcome from that conversation. That person's like, oh, thank you so much for telling me that. And sometimes it's not that way. You know, sometimes there's a lot of resistance. You misread the situation. Sometimes you realize you were not as clear as you thought. So I think it's also helpful to bring a sense of longer commitment to those conversations. A sense of, okay, let's try this conversation, and if it doesn't go well, come back again and say, you know, I didn't say that in a very skillful way, or I didn't realize this aspect. And so you're willing to kind of take it through for a while and not to have this agenda that the person should act a certain way after we give them this beautiful feedback, as we give this expression of truth. Because also it can take a form of, if I share this, I will be seen, I will be loved, I will be appreciated. And sometimes the person's distracted or is reactive, and then suddenly there's that, oh, that really touches that deep need to want, the deep wanting to be acknowledged. So to again, be willing to see what's the truth that's arising each moment, including as we're speaking, including how the other person's responding. Because it is this dance. Yes. Sure, so the comment or question is about elaborating on whether it's pleasant or unpleasant, and then how does that play into this whole matrix. Really, the sutta kind of focuses on that. You know, that's kind of the crux of the question, you know, that the prince is trying to trap the Buddha in. Is this, you know, do you only say things which are pleasant? Or do you never say things which are unpleasant? You know, how does that play out? And it's, again, the Buddha kind of reframes the whole question as, you know, that's not the initial concern, is whether it's true, is it beneficial? And then you look at whether it's pleasant or unpleasant. So, I mean, we all got a sense of that. If we give a compliment, it's going to be well received, hopefully. If it's a criticism or a sense of feedback, it may not be received so well. And so that, I think, often really this commitment to truth and to being beneficial, to really wanting to release suffering for all beings, for myself, that helps to kind of overcome the initial inertia, the initial fear of saying something difficult to someone else. It's like, you know, I'm coming from a place of well-wishing, of wanting us to have a more harmonious relationship, to have myself stand up for a boundary, for that person to see some way that they're unconscious and causing harm. But framing it from this wish to ease suffering, to live that beneficial quality to it, I think helps to soften that part. The other part of everyone that's pleasing, it's really interesting to look at that too, because is there any hidden motivation around that? If I say something, if I really, you know, praise you, if I really, there's all kinds of little statements we say, you know, I'm not going to say them right now, when you're basically kissing up to somebody else, there's that agenda. If I praise them, I'll get something in return, or I'll get this point of nice connection, or they will like me more. So again, being very honest. So it's like you're being honest all the way through it. You know, that intention to say something, go through the gates as you're saying it, Because you start to actually act on it, it's like you're really upping the intensity of it. Because when we're kind of just thinking about it, there's kind of a way we can think, oh, that feels pretty good. We start to actually look at the other person in the eye and share this. Suddenly we may see, okay, there's some dissonance here. There's some wanting it to go a certain way or wanting something back from that person. So I think the best way to do it is that sense of just simply giving it as an offering, as a gift. And you know, whether it's beneficial, whether it's pleasant or unpleasant, that's kind of the sense of grit, that sense of fortitude that I will be able to have this conversation even though it may be difficult. You're welcome.
I've been in all kinds of therapy and I already thought I had it down. But the other person just flew up and took it and completely took me completely by surprise with anger, rejection.
Right.
So what would you do with that afterward?
Okay, so the comment was on a particular situation, kind of doing all the right things, I statements, really owning your experience. And giving that to another person, another person just took it a completely different way, really didn't receive it in the right way. And then what would you do with that? I mean, one thing is, there's many different ways to look at it and to work with it. I think the primary way is for you to really attend to yourself. Because you thought it was going to go a certain way, and there's going to be a lot of, you know, echoes from that. You know, I thought I was going to say it well, I thought I was going to be received well. And to attend to those, to see how each of those qualities of rejection, of fear, of losing connection, of not being loved, all show these qualities of identification. So again, when I say that, I hope you don't see it as this sense of a kind of a cool, robotic mind that's kind of getting rid of all this identification. It's really done through the heart's release. The heart really sees where the pain is and sees, holds it very tenderly, and in that tenderness you start to see how the part of the pain, or in the central part of the pain, is through the meaning of identification. So it's really seen through the heart. So that's one part, is to really attend to yourself around that. The other part is you have to do some follow-up at conversations. Reflect on, kind of go through these three gateways again. Was this really true? Was there a hidden agenda? Was there was the timing really right? Was that person really busy and stressed? And I felt good, I felt ready to tell them, but they were, in retrospect, it was the end of the day, they were really tired, they just had a big fight with their significant other, and boom. You know, and then, but ultimately, if the relationship is strong enough, if the container of the relationship is strong enough, you can come back and see, you know, really where the misinterpretation was, where the miscommunication was. Because unfortunately, we say one word, another person interprets it completely different. And that's the nature of the human mind, the nature of the process of an individual conditioning. Like with my wife this morning, I would say something that was kind of more of a, you know, why didn't you do this? And she heard a deep sense of attack on her, that you're incompetent, you're never going to be good, you're lazy. And that wasn't my intention, but I could also tell the way I was carrying that energy, how it would be interpreted that way. So you have to kind of also gauge the strength of the container, or another way to say the strength of the relationship. You know, so you probably don't want to share your deepest truth with the checkout clerk. There's not that established, like, okay, we're going to stay with it through the thick and thin and the all the hurt. So it's kind of that sense of modulating how much you really need to share, too. You know, it might be, you might take it in a very sideways way, in a skillful way, to say, you know, how was your day? Or I felt a little abrupt, or just that, you know, there's a lot of nuances. So I think sometimes, especially if you've done a lot of therapy, therapeutic work, psychological work, we have this urge to want to share the deepest part of ourselves. And sometimes the container isn't the right container for that. Yeah. Yes. It is a conversation. So the comment was, we're talking about speaking the truth, but what about receiving the truth? You know, how does that work? Because it is a two-way street. And I think that's a very important truth. I mean, an important aspect to bring out is that we have to look at our own relationship to receiving feedback, to receiving someone else's truth. And if we're not very open to that, it should bring a certain questioning to how much we can really assert our own truth. Because if we're not open to it, most likely we're caught in our own sense of opinion, our sense of concept, our sense of belief about ourselves and others. Right? To be willing to receive truth, we have to be willing to question all those. Okay, so there's a whole, you know, psychology of that. But from a dharmic standpoint, we're questioning the very belief in self. And so when you start to find yourself being more fluid to be able to really take something in and say, okay, that resonates or that doesn't resonate. It's like, as I look at my practice over the last 22 years, certainly the beginning I would be much more not very permeable. Feedback would be, you know, like, oh, that really means I'm really bad, or, you know, I'll take it internally and make this whole belief about me. But I find that as my practice matures, there's a sense of fluidity, a sense of not really taking rest in any one spot. And so as I see your feedback, it's like there's a sense of, okay, let me hear that. Let me receive that. And times when I'm not like that, then okay, that's something to really attend to. So I think it's also helpful along those lines is to advocate for the timing. To really, what I mean by that is to notice, when am I able to really receive? When am I open to hearing? Because there's times when my wife or someone else may want to share something. I'm like, okay, I'm not open to this right now. I will be, but right now I'm not. And to respect that. I think that's also where we tend to get astray, is when we think, I have to be open all the time to hearing everything from everybody. And you know, okay, my mind is not receptive right now. Or it is receptive. Like that polishing the stone, one of the structures of that is you have someone who's not giving feedback, who's just monitoring and noticing, okay, when is that receptivity there and when it's not? And when you can see when someone starts to tighten up and their breath starts to get restricted, it's time to kind of stop that exchange. To wait till the receptivity is. Because if it is going to often very tender spots in us, and then maybe just need a little bit to receive it, work with it, and then come back and get some more. Yeah. And ultimately, that we also learn this through our own internal feedback, that deep sense of honesty, really seeing things. And when it's a sense of, like I didn't realize I was arrogant or I was lustful or something I deeply judge, how do I hold that? And the more receptive I can be to my own experience, it naturally goes outward. Since, you know, that sense of being lack of release of separation, that's when we start to see it. We start to release you start to release the need to be a certain way.
do for the rest of my life, because you pack a lot into this. I have heard, is it true, is it beneficial, is the timing right?
Right.
And they've been much more superficial than the questions you put in here.
Mm.
And so I can really see that my own issues, which one of them is not wanting to have conflict, so I will, you know, not say anything, or I will, you know, I see it as something I'm really working on. And I can see that the things you pointed out here really will help me. I mean, they feel like that's part of the problem. You identify those, like identification is a part of that, and
yes.
Vulnerability is another part of it.
Yes.
And also the fact that you asked about the inner dialogue. I think that's really important, because I often see a real connection between my inner dialogue and my outer dialogue. So I really appreciate the homework.
Good, thank you. So the comment is appreciation for the homework and how it has a lot of stuff to it. Some of the points just to bring out too is that sense of when we have fear of conflict, you know, how does that factor in here? And that also the sense of inner dialogue and how that's a mirror of our external dialogue. You know, often we wonder why we can't have kind speech. But think how much you talk to yourself in an unkind way. How much time do you practice talking in an unkind way to yourself? You know, so then it's naturally when you go out to talk to someone else, that's your default. So the fastest way to really work with this is to work with your own internal dialogue. And what does that look like? You know, so much of like, oh, I'm such this, I'm no good, I'm not up to the task, I'm not lovable, I'm not wanted, or projection outward, that person doesn't respect me. So often we just keep elaborating on that, we keep adding more and more to that. Okay, so this is really a point toward an encouragement to pause. To pause. That's all it takes, is a pause. It's like you get on this boat and it just you buy into the whole stream, and before you realize it, you're on your deathbed, filled with fear, filled with anger. But you have meditation. Mindfulness brings this potentiality, this potential to actually meet each moment with a choice. So care for your mind like you would care for a loved one. Care for your mind like you would for a cherished child. How you would not be critical or hurt that child through your words. Why not do that for yourself? Why not? I challenge anyone to have a good reason. And it's not based in belief, it's not based in self-hatred. And so it takes a lot of courage, because think how long you've been practicing that, right? So that arises, that self-dislike, that constriction, it arises. Okay, and just pause. Just bring a little bit of space to it. As I started to really work with this, there's a becoming more and more sensitive to the subtle qualities that this would show up. I almost felt like I was attuning my nose to detect a little scent of self-hatred, right? So I was becoming more sensitive to it. I start to find that instead of saying, okay, I'm such a failure, no one's going to ever like me, I'm never going to da-da-da-da, it would start to become a shorter and shorter sentence. I start to elaborate less and less on it. I'm such an idiot, pause. And be like, I'm such an idiot, pause. I'm such a, pause. Pause. And that way, just slowly start to back into that moment. So then the inner stillness becomes the natural state by attending with care to ourselves. And the other aspect of one of the things, just the sense of conflict, fear of conflict. Okay, I'm afraid of saying this because I would rather just kind of avoid the conflict. Where's the identification? You can see how it's very beneficial to actually stand up for yourself. Not only because you have a healthier life, but you're also directly challenging that identification. Yeah. We probably have time for one more. Yes. Yes.
Because on one side, speaking truth, I have a sense that what we say is actually relative to our experience. So it's never completely absolute. It's always
right.
And on the other hand, meditation practice tends to let us look back at that experience itself.
Yes.
And say it's only an experience, and it's only a play.
Yes.
Your profile, your class, your
gender. Right, yeah, exactly.
So,
yeah.
And most of the time when I want to speak about truth, it's a part of that experience that I'm clinging to.
Yes.
And so,
yes, nice.
What part of that experience should we cling to enough to speak about?
Ah, nice. Nice question. So let me see if I can, for the recording, capture some of the essentials. Just the sense of the reflection on the practice allows us to tap into really what's experientially true. But at the same time, we see that so much of what we take as being true is based on our conditioning, our background, our history. And how do we, and that is inherent in a sense of clinging, a sense of constriction. And so how do we balance those to have enough clinging to be able to actually speak the truth? Well, this is what's really interesting. Can you speak what's true in the moment at the same time releasing as soon as you've said it? So in other words, instead of thinking that I have to, constrict it, you're just holding in a very light way. But you may say something like, okay, I'm feeling really sad right now. As you say it, there's not a sense of, constriction around it, but there's a sense of releasing it as you're saying it. There's a sense of fluidity that is actually embodied as the words are coming out. In fact, you start to attune to that by speaking my experience right now, you're actually releasing any identification as you say it. And you start to notice those edges too, like, okay, I'm really embarrassed about saying this, or I'm intimidated by this person, or I feel judged by this person. Those are all forms of constriction. And if it feels like it's a safe environment to practice that, to actually push that edge, and you see for yourself that the more, it's like you start to attune yourself to those places of rub. I sometimes think of it as if you had a big sheet of silk, and you're rubbing it over a smooth surface, it would just glide effortlessly. But let's say there's a few pebbles and a little, twigs and stuff, it kind of snags on those places. Those snags are often what needs some kind of expression. And the magical thing is we are willing to hold that, and often it has a lot of meaning and pain to it. If we're actually willing to share it, we find it dissolves as we share it. Does that help? Sort of? You want to follow up? Ask me.
I think it's in that pose we take between the moment when we think about I want to say that and the moment when we actually say it that it might dissolve before saying it. But
right.
But if it's strong enough to keep up to saying it, then it will dissolve. That's what I understand.
Yes, and it. And there's also a sense of, we also share to connect, the willingness to really share our hearts. And that also loosens up this quality of separation by saying, okay, let me share what's here. And so, whether there's a large charge or a little charge, here's a good rule of thumb. Notice what your default is, what your natural tendency is, and then go opposite of that. Right? So if you tend to be, because, you know, I tend to be kind of quiet and not share a lot, so I can take this teaching, oh, it's, I don't have to say anything because I, it just, you know, it's all empty. But it's actually really beneficial for me to practice saying more, because that way it actually challenges that deep identification around shyness. On the other hand, if I'm always speaking, I'm always sharing, and, you know, I'm the first to speak, being silent is more of the challenge. So we're like, where the edge of challenge is also the edge of the greatest growth. All right, thank you. Thank you all for your sincerity and the heartfelt questions.